We'll have our own little South by Southwest support group. And then we'll go have cocktail after we finish.
Nice.
And you can critique the talk. It's funny, this was a little bit of a last minute talk. It wasn't originally on the schedule, but I had been on a panel with Hugh Forrest, who's the executive director of Interactive, and they had somebody drop out. So, like, can you come talk on virtual support? And I love virtual support because I've been involved with it for a really long time. So, but yeah, you don't like it when you're sitting in the green room and you hear, you're up against Sean Parker and Al Gore. Awesome. But that's all right. We'll persevere. All right. So here's a little bit about what we're going to go through. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my own story, my personal story, and why I'm even remotely qualified to stand up here and talk about virtual support. And then what is support? What does that mean? And how have digital advances changed support systems? Because when I was diagnosed in 93, it was a whole different world than what it is today. And there have been some really interesting sort of ripple effects and other impacts out of this change in support systems. And then we will end with a love story. Always the best ending. Hashtag Livestrong?
Yeah. For this.
Hashtag Livestrong. Okay. I don't know if it's South by Southwest Livestrong is a little long.
Yeah. I just didn't want it to get mixed up before you're all
the other stuff. I think it'll be good. Call it a day. All right. Oh, we're having our own virtual support group, so you have to introduce yourself. Hi, David. Welcome. So, I'm going to start a little bit with my own story. This is me before cancer. Just your ordinary, average, invincible young adult. So when I was in my mid-20s, I was traveling around the world. I had finished college. I was living in London and in Paris and at the Grand Canyon. And I was backpacking and bartending and just having a grand old time and just really doing what you're supposed to do in your 20s, which is really just try and figure out who you are and what you want to do and who you want to be and how you want to have relationships and make decisions and all of those things. And so I was just on this great sort of trip. And I had moved home from Paris, and I had gone to work at the Grand Canyon, and then I had sort of ended up where a lot of 20-somethings end up after they do these kind of things, which is in my parents' guest bedroom at 26, but just to figure out where I was going to go next. It was not meant to be permanent, right? So the funny thing was that shortly after I got there, I started having these pains in my ankle. And they were excruciating. And they would wake me up night after night after night. And so I started the treadmill of doctors. And I started just trying to figure out what this was. And I kept pushing and I kept pushing and I kept pushing. So 8 months later, 4 doctors, 1 physical therapist, horrible treatments, ultrasound treatments, x-rays. Finally, I had an MRI and a biopsy, and they told me that I had what's called Ewing sarcoma, which is a type of bone cancer. So I was 26 years old, and someone had just told me I had bone cancer. And I was living in my parents' guest bedroom, and I didn't know anything about anything. And so that started me on the path of my cancer life. I left my real life behind and I went into my cancer life. And the thing about this, there are a few sort of key points that I realized as I was going into cancer life, is that every time I walked into a waiting room or a doctor's office, I never saw anyone my own age. Everybody was my grandparents' age, and they were super nice. But So sort of a follow-on to that is that all the materials, all the support, all the resources, they were all geared to those really nice old people. And so they weren't talking about things that I wanted to know about, like how to date or, you know, when to tell someone that I had cancer or how was I going to get a job again or all of these things that were just rocking my world. And there was no one to sort of bounce that experience off of. So over the course of the next 18 months, during my treatment and after my treatment, I met a grand total of 4 young people. And this is in Dallas, Texas. This is a major city, major medical center, but it was totally by random chance. Like, there was no sort of formal recognition of the fact that I might want to talk to someone my own age, except for a nurse who kind of was like, I know this patient and you might want to meet that patient. It was just random. And one guy, the first guy I ever met, actually, this is a funny story. I just checked into the hospital and had just been hooked up to my port. And I heard, because I would go in for 5 days at a time, and I heard somewhere, this is back in 94, U2's Joshua Tree album playing. And I was like, that person is under 40, and I'm going to find them. And so I grabbed my pole, and I just started walking up and down and up and down the halls until I found the door where the music was coming from, and I knocked, and sure enough, it was John. And he was a 19 years old, osteosarcoma patient, and we became fast friends, just like that. So the worst part of the whole story, though, is not that I only met 4 people in 18 months, but 3 of them died. So it was really, really lonely. And having found that support and that group in this place where I didn't see anybody else, you know, that was hard enough. But then having it and then losing it was terrible and terrifying, and all of those things all rolled up into one. This was the support group available to me in 1994. Not really, but that's how I saw them. Literally, I went to the first support group, and I opened the door, and I walked in, and I was like, and if I could have turned around and walked out without being seen, I totally would have, but I couldn't. They'd already seen me. And they'd already started the, you're so precious, and you're so young to get cancer. And one lady just burst into tears. I'm like, really, that's not helpful. And the one next to her wanted to set me up with her grandson. I'm like, ugh. So they were, not to discount the fact that these are really nice people, but they're talking about whether to do chemo so they'll have hair or not to walk down the aisle when their granddaughter gets married. I'm trying to figure out if I'm ever going to be able to have kids, period. So it was a very different world back then. So when you think about that, you think, well, they could have supported you emotionally. They could have said, oh, you know, it's going to be okay, or you could have talked about things, but it just wasn't the right fit, right? But according to Wikipedia, in a support group, members provide each other with types of help, usually non-professional and non-material, for a particular shared, usually burdensome characteristic. That's a good word, actually. Cancer. Cancer's burdensome. I'm going to use that. So the help may take the form of providing and evaluating relevant information, relating personal experiences, listening to and accepting others' experiences, providing sympathetic understanding, and establishing social networks. So again, they could have sort of done that. Whoop. But it may also work to inform the public or engage in advocacy, which I was interested that this was actually in the definition. And we'll come back to that because that is sort of where we're going to look at that a little closer down the road. But in a nutshell, it's I want to find people like me. I want to find people who can understand my challenges, who can relate to them, who can reflect it back to me and say, you're not crazy because I feel the same way. You know, we could talk about things like, we talked about everything, you know, vomit and laughter. And is it okay to ask not to have that nurse because you don't really like her? And, you know, is it okay to be buried in blue jeans? And, you know, those kind of conversations that we really were only going to have with each other. So this is what it used to be like back in the day, back when I was in a support group 1.0, like 10 people in a room around a box of Kleenex. Not to say that that's not, there are not very valuable things about an in-person support group, but I think what's so interesting is how things have evolved and how digital advances and that, oops, how's that going to stop? And the internet really make a difference. And they've made a difference because there's so many avenues now for support. There's people who have personal blogs where they share their own story out. And a large group or a small select group can interact with that blog, can provide comments, can provide support. Caring Bridge, I'm sure you're all familiar with Caring Bridge, where, you know, personal pages, private, that you can invite people to. It's the blog, sort of the journal, the online journal and photos. Facebook is easily a support community, depending on how widely you want to share your process or your journey, or if you want a group, or if you want to just put it out there on your page. Planet Cancer is the online community that I had started, and we'll talk more about that. A private proprietary community for young people with cancer. And then Patients Like Me, which is another very interesting model that we'll talk about, where people have a community and they also share their data. But there's just so many different avenues and different ways for people to develop their support systems nowadays. And I think it makes for a completely different experience from the one that I had in the early 90s. So after I had finished my own treatment, I sort of went away from cancer for a while. Had to get over that transition, that shoving you off the cliff kind of feeling, and to sort of process what exactly had happened to me. And the thing that kept coming front and center in my mind as I met people was, I can't have been the only one. Like, there have to be more people. There have to be more people like me out there. So couple years later, I finished my treatment in 95, and then a few years later, when I moved here from Connecticut, I thought, you know, it's time. And the internet had reached a place where I thought, there are young people out there. They're all online. They're all on websites. It just needs to be a website. I need to put a website just recognizing this fact and just see who comes. So I started a website called Planet Cancer. And then over time, it evolved into it started out as just message boards, and then it evolved into this support network. It was built on a Ning platform. But it was really the first of its kind, and I think it's still the largest of its kind, where people come, they join, they talk to other young people, they have their own page where they can blog, they can post photos, they can post videos. And there were just some really interesting learnings from starting this online community. So, for example, when we started it, they have a groups functionality. So we started this, we seeded it, you know, and we thought, oh, people will want to talk to other people who have their same diagnosis. So we started a couple around diagnosis, a couple of groups. But then what happened, interestingly enough, sort of as they evolved, is people started setting up their own groups. And they were the most random groups you could possibly imagine. There was one for Melissa's who have cancer. There was one for people who couldn't have gotten through this without their pets. There was one for, I'm just sort of making it, oh, there was one about not even cancer related at all. It was just people who have an irrational fear of zombies. Would you?
It's going to happen. I believe the zombie apocalypse. Keep talking.
And that group will be so well prepared. So it's not irrational. We just tell them to strike irrational from their name. But I guess the point of that is that, besides the fact that the zombie apocalypse is imminent, which I agree, is that people want to define the experience in their own way. They don't want me or anybody else to say, this is your experience, and this is how you're going to do cancer, and this is how you're going to get through it, and these are the people you need to talk to, because maybe those are not the people you need to talk to. So I thought that was really an interesting fact. This is another sort of version of an online support group, Pillars for Life, which we're working with at the foundation right now in our community impact project voting, where we replicate these programs in communities all around the country. This community votes to bring the funding to their community and to their hospital or center. So it's pretty cool to see the support that a program like this can generate. It's was originally a face-to-face support group curriculum, online coping skills based on these sort of seven pillars that they present in a very highly structured process. And so what they've done is they've translated it into an online version and then also introduced a social networking portal sort of to allow that aspect of community to help people as they go through the pillars and as they go through the highly structured piece, they can process it through the community with other people in their group. So they have these virtual training groups. You can choose whether to do it by phone, by video conference, if you're feeling, you know, up to it. A lot of times you just want to sit on the phone and you don't want anyone to see you. But it's 75 minutes of trained social workers with your group. So it broadens the network of support while teaching the skills of the program at the same time. So that's another sort of more structured model that's just about really adapting the face-to-face into the online. A little less freewheeling than sort of general peer support on Planet Cancer or personal sort of processing through a blog. So I think the introduction of advances in digital technology have really introduced some unique benefits of online support. Anonymity is a big one. You can reveal yourself as much or as little as you want. You can put all the information out there and hide who you are, or put yourself out there and you decide how much information you want to share. I was talking to one of our social workers before I came over today, and she was wondering if people were more afraid of privacy, you know, had more concern of privacy issues with online. And I said, well, you know, if you think about it, it's probably six of one, half dozen to another, because in a regular support group, you're trusting that the people in the group with you are not going to share your information as well. So, but here, at least you have a little control over how much people know about you and who you are, depending on the channels that you pick and share. Social distance, which I think is really interesting. It's awkward sometimes if you've spilled your guts to somebody and then the next day you see them at work or, you know, at a party. And sometimes that can be challenging, and it maybe will keep you from sharing things that you need to share. So online, if you're talking to someone who's in the next country or six states away, you have a little more protection from those kind of situations. A greater range of expertise, just by virtue of the fact that so many more people are online and are looking for these places and sharing this information, you can find people who have more experience or who have more expertise, patients who have been through what you're going through and can advise you. You can pool, you know, information from several different people and then make a better decision. Ability to edit oneself has been proven to be a really powerful piece of the online support that you wouldn't have face-to-face. You know, once you say something and it's out there, and the retraction just isn't that easy. But you can always write something and let it sit and walk away and then come back to it and decide if that's what you really wanted to say or not. If you post something, you can go back and take it down. 9 times out of 10, you can take it back. So it's that ability to edit. Of course, we've all done the put it out there and then be like, oh, God. But maybe it's a little easier to get over in the online space instead of in person. This was a big one for young adults. And when I go around and I talk to healthcare professionals about support for young adults, 24/7 access, regardless of your location, is huge. I mean, in our society today, we're used to getting what we want when we want it. If you want to buy a book, you can go onto Amazon and download the ebook immediately. You don't have to wait for the store to open at 10 o'clock the next morning and walk in and pick it up. So one of the problems with face-to-face support groups, especially for younger people who are used to this, I want it and I want it now, is the fact that maybe if you pitch something as, you know, we have this great support group, but it's every third Thursday at 6 o'clock, and you have to be approved, and then you have to commit to 6 months, and then, oh, by the way, it's in the hospital, that place that makes you want to throw up every time you go near it. And they're like, oh, I wondered why it didn't work. Oh, just think about it, you know, and not to mention that just the words for a young person in particular, support group, has all kinds of connotations. That's like, oh, I don't want to sit around in a room and talk about cancer with a bunch of people I don't know. So there's a lot of ways around that in a face-to-face setting that we talk about, but I think that's one of the benefits of online support is you can go online and you can pretty much find someone to talk to ask questions with anytime you need it. Asynchronous participation. This is an interesting feature. You could post a question and someone doesn't have to be online right then to respond to your question. They can come in later and answer your question. You don't have to collect this group of people at a specific time in order to have this back and forth, in order to have this support. You can be separate. You can do it at your convenience, which I think is again, another part of just participating in the way that's right for you, when it's right for you. The larger pool of support people, known and strangers. It always amazes me when I go on Caring Bridge or even on some really popular bloggers, the people who are interacting with the community who don't even know that person. They will just come on and willingly offer support or say, I'm thinking about you, or, you know, have a great day. And it kind of restores your faith in humanity a little bit, the fact that people can be free with sharing support or offering encouragement with someone they don't know just because something in their story resonated with that person. They were brought there somehow, and then the story struck a chord, and they're willing to offer that kind of support. This is probably true as well with face-to-face support, but I think there's something about maybe it can last longer in an online forum, but people who come to get help stick around to give help. There's always the wise veterans in the groups who can chime in with a voice of reason or certain experiences or just some bit of guidance that perhaps they've just gained from being there for a long time. So, and that it helps them to help other people. If you're the person who continues in a face-to-face support group, you know, for 2 years, it might get kind of creepy after a while, depending on the situation. But I think online, it's much more free-flowing, and I think is a benefit to coming out of the larger pool of people that you have these folks who end up wanting to give back, and this is how they choose to do it. So the unique benefits of face-to-face connection, because there are those, you can see body language, you can hear tone of voice. That is lost online, and as we all know, that can cause misunderstandings, that can cause angst, you know, in certain situations. But you can see body language, you can hear tone of voice, and you can respond and interact appropriately. So it's easier that way. More local information. Support groups that are face-to-face are really great for sharing information in your own city, in your own town, dishing on a specific doctor or nurse or, you know, facility, hospital. Shared social experiences, dinner, drinks, outings, those are all, you know, great for support. If you need help, a lot of times you can call local friends who have been, you know, face-to-face that you feel comfortable in saying, hey, I need some help. I can't drive myself to the doctor today. And they're the ones who will understand because they've been in that group with you. And you can't underestimate the power of human contact and hugs. So I think it's interesting to note that nowadays, with the digital channels that we have, people can craft support systems to meet various needs and situations. So you could even have, whereas, you know, back in the 90s, there was one option for me. It was this group, and it was, you know, every other Thursday, and that was it. But now, people could have their Facebook page where they might give general updates. So friends and family would know what's going on and can say, I'm thinking about you while you go to get your treatment today. You can also there, you know, reach out to strangers or people you don't know who will also come on and support you. But then maybe you have your blog that you only share with your family or with your closest friend, or you have a private group on Facebook, some other way that's closed where you can, or if you go on Planet Cancer and you have a Planet Cancer page, like those are your cancer peeps. You're going to talk to them about something totally different than you're going to talk about on your Facebook page, because you don't want to put that. Most people wouldn't want to put just the in the trenches piece of it. A lot of times people will protect their friends and family from those really sometimes gritty and dark thoughts or worries or concerns. So you'll protect people, but you'll work it out with your people who understand because they've been there. What I think is really interesting and what we're going to talk about for a little now is that a community of support can fluidly become a community of action. So it's sort of along the lines of that people who get help want to give help. Communities of support, if they're around a particular need or challenge or issue or discover a particular solution, can turn very quickly into advocates and people who want to change something or fix something, which I think is really, really interesting. And I don't think would have happened without the influence of digital technology and digital advances and the way to amplify a message and bring together a large group of people, or even not so large, very quickly. And it goes back to that taking action can in turn improve a patient's experience. We've had done some research at the foundation that actually shows that people who take action, who get engaged, who participate in some sort of empowerment or activity actually do feel better. So I think what that says at the end of the day is that a community, regardless of how it started or what the purpose is, equals power, and there is power in people sharing their voices and sharing their stories and then perhaps moving in a particular direction. So I would say that support systems can improve clinical experience. They can influence research, which can translate into improved outcomes, and even influence policy. So how can support systems improve the clinical experience? This is a friend of mine. Her name's Susan. She was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she was one of the first women in the States to use these things called penguin cold caps, which stop hair loss due to chemotherapy. She was the first at her cancer center, one of the first in the country, but she had literally, when she found out she was going to have to do chemo and that she was going to lose her hair, there was no question about it, almost decided not to do chemotherapy. It was that serious for her. So she went online and she found this solution and she said, I'm going to do that. Everyone thought she was nuts at her cancer center. The nurses, the doctors, they were all, every time, they were like, okay, you know, well, now you're going to lose your hair. But they helped. They let her bring in her 3 igloo coolers filled with dry ice and cold caps, and with the timing, they worked on her with the timing. But she said her only support came from women on breastcancer.org. There's a group of women who had used the cold caps. So now, a couple of years later, she's coached hundreds of women on using these caps. She went on there to get support, And now she is giving support, and she is helping people who are coming in through the same channels that she did. But she says, it's without understating, that it's been her primary emotional support, social support, and spiritual support. She also went in for just support with the CAPS, and it turned into something a lot bigger, because this is the community that she joined. This is the community that she's a part of. She never lost her hair. It ended up with Good Morning America doing a story on the cold caps with other women from the website. They just finished a clinical study here at UCSF, and they're on track for FDA approval. So it wasn't just about support or helping individuals through their experience, although that was really important, and that's why they started. But this was taken from that interview, which the friend says, it seems silly to say that chemo was this happy day, but it was this enormously positive, upbeat thing where we all knew we were helping a dear friend. We also knew we were doing something that was potentially going to help a lot of other people. So, you know, there was a lot more riding on it than just Shirley's great hair. It became bigger. It became something that would improve the clinical experience for women. As those doctors, as Susan's doctors saw what was happening and the nurses saw what was happening, now they recommend it to patients. They say, you can try this. Other people have done it. It could make your experience better. And if that makes someone do chemotherapy who wouldn't have done it otherwise, who would have chosen not to, that's a big deal. On the second question, how can support systems influence research? The Live Strong Young Adult Alliance is something that I became part of with Planet Cancer, and then as part of Live Strong as well. But it really goes back to, again, the early sort of 2000, when the internet gave the young adult movement a launching pad. Because prior to that time, people were like me. Everyone was isolated. Everyone was very spread out between pediatric facilities, adult facilities. You never saw anyone your own age. So you didn't, the thought in the back of your head was always, I've got to be the only one. But once young adults were able to start coming together online and supporting each other, then they started gaining a voice. And they started realizing shared issues. And they started noticing that no doctors ever talked to us about the fact that I might lose my fertility. Or, you know, thinking about how I could stay in school because I need to keep my insurance. And that's the only way I'm going to do it. So there was a realization of shared challenges and issues. And as the young adults were supporting each other, there started popping up all these advocacy groups that were started by young people, mostly about particular issues or challenges. So there was one for pregnant with cancer. There was one for one-to-one support. There was another one about cancer and careers. So all of these advocacy organizations that were started went first to Sense, which is sort of action, you know, adventure sessions for people who've, young adults who finished treatment. You know, it's kayaking, it's rock climbing. But as these groups started maturing or coming together and working together and helping each other and referring people to each other, eventually, under the auspices of Livestrong, we all came together as a coalition. And it wasn't just advocacy organizations. It was doctors. It was researchers. It was hospitals. And then even the NCI was involved to sort of take a look at this age group in particular and what are the challenges. And realizing, oh, by the way, survival rates for this group haven't improved in 30 years. But no one had noticed because no one ever looked at it as a group before. So with all the advances in research and treatment, no one actually looked and said, hey, wait, that's been absolutely flat. Even though kids have gone up here and older people's survival rates have improved up here. So in less than a decade since these groups started coming together, the journal articles have just exponentially increased. There were, from 1990 to 2000, it was literally this sort of flat line of like 100 to 200 articles every year. And then by 2009, there were over 4,000 articles about young adults. As you all know, given your backgrounds, the pace, you know, that kind of pace, that kind of advances, that's like warp speed in cancer terminology. So Young adults were the only age group singled out for cancer research funding in the economic stimulus package. And AYA oncology is now recognized as a valid subspecialty. You can actually train a fellow in young adult oncology. It's a career path. No one's going to tell you that you're throwing your career down the toilet if you say, hey, I want to work with young adults. So it's really exciting to see the change, but it all started when young adults were able to come together and support each other. That was the seed of the whole explosion. Patients Like Me is another really interesting model. Patients come on here, they share their stories with each other. They have an online community mostly around rare diseases. So, you know, I thought it was hard to find other young people, but some of the diagnoses on here are so extremely rare where, you know, to find other people who are going through the same thing is really hard. They share their stories. They also share certain data points, but the company, Patients Like Me, de-identifies the data and sells the info to people who, companies who are working on solutions for those problems. Data can be pooled, so a lot of times that can move questions along even further. This year, they were featured as one of the most 50 innovative companies by MIT's Technology Review, and I am the founders are from MIT, so. You know, who knows what that has to do with it, but it's still cool. The key innovation was they published this peer-reviewed study based on data volunteered by site users, and there had been a clinical trial that thought maybe had an early indication that lithium would be helpful in slowing progression of ALS, and the site users came together. They built some tools for them to pool their data around this, and 18 months earlier than a traditional clinical trial, they came back and said, no, that's not true. It doesn't work. So it was a lot faster and it was a lot cheaper. So there's promise in these kind of support systems. If people are willing to share their data, something we're really interested in at Livestrong too, is if people have control over their data, they can be empowered. They can choose when to share it and how to share it and for what trials. So it's something that we're looking towards in the future as being a significant advances. How can they influence policy? Fertile Hope is another young adult organization. You might be noticing a theme here. Started by Lindsay Beck, a woman who, when she was told she had tongue cancer, asked the question, is this going to affect my ability to have a family, which was really, really important to her. And back in that day, I mean, I didn't even think to ask the question, but she did, and they told her it might. And she said, that's not acceptable. So she delayed her treatment until she had researched and found someone who was doing experimental egg freezing. And she froze her eggs and then went on through her treatment. Now, after she finished, she still had that feeling of that was unacceptable and that shouldn't happen. So she started this organization. She built a community of women who had, not just women, there were men as well, but who were dealing with that same question, to whom that question was really important. And she started also trying to change the system. She basically, this group of people brought together the worlds of reproductive medicine and oncology and made them talk to each other and realize that there were impacts, but there were also solutions. And if they could work together, they could come up with solutions that would improve quality of life for the patients. So now ASCO and the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, the oncology side and the reproductive medicine side, they both have recommendations on fertility preservation for cancer patients. Hospitals are changing their policies, requiring that fertility information be shared. And then the next step now is after listening to people saying, you know, it's great if the doctors say that, but my insurance won't cover it, because they don't cover infertility. But it's medically, chemotherapy-induced infertility is very different from traditional infertility. So it's changing the definition. So it's talking to insurance providers and to employers to convince them to change the terms of their policy and their coverage. So again, it was this community of support that was built around a need or concern, and it's changing everything for patients who are coming after. So back to that finding someone like me, which is really at the heart of the matter, I think. We can talk about policy and advocacy and change and systems. But really, what starts it all and where it all comes back to is a person finding another person. And so this is the love story part. That's JT. And that is Teresa with her son. Not JT's son, by the way. Because, as he said, for being a 26-year-old gay dude and a 38-year-old married mother of one, we were quite the pair. So JT and Teresa met on Planet Cancer. And I'm going to read you a little bit from a blog post that JT had written about Teresa. And to me, this just sort of embodies why we need support, why we need to think about support and offering support to patients, cancer patients, or any other patient. Because at the end of the day, this is what it's about. It's about the relationships and about people being able to find other people like them. He wrote this after Teresa died. He did say I could share it with you. He was very excited. He says, I wrote the following today to pay tribute to the girl who saved me every day in ways both big and small. I felt compelled to share about the power of hope and friendship and the beauty of human connection within the context of the fight. He starts out, I remember the day my beautiful Teresa stole my heart. So they didn't really know anything about each other. Teresa lived in San Francisco. JT was going through his treatment in Houston, and then for a brief spell in New York, and then back to Houston. But they did know that both of them had been diagnosed with ALL, which is acute leukemia, and they had finished treatment. So they were on Planet Cancer trying to figure out what their new reality was. They were struggling with this new reality. But they started having these conversations, and they realized that maybe they were sort of kindred spirits, and they had a lot in common, and they, besides the diagnosis, but there were a lot of other things. So they talked about nausea and food fear. He says to her, I mentioned to her that while I hated drinking nutritional supplements, if we made it a game, it'd be cooler. We could play Ensure Pong. It's like beer pong, only we drink Ensure instead of beer. And she quickly and very matter-of-factly responded, did you know that Boost Pudding comes up almost exactly the same as it goes down? True story. An hour in, it comes up, I could have re-eaten it. And he says, she had me at Boost Pudding regurgitation. He says, I finally felt what I'd been needing to feel, understood, and I realized that was exactly what had been missing. In this world of support, we just want to be understood. And the things that we think are important may not be obvious. Boost Pudding, who knew? But he says, that epiphany was as life-changing as my cancer had been. Only it felt like this new friendship was fighting back. It felt like our friendship had begun to rebuild all the things inside of us that we felt cancer had destroyed. After they met and connected with each other, they both relapsed. He relapsed, and then she relapsed a few weeks later. And they went through bone marrow transplants within a week of each other. It was his first, her second. And then they relapsed again, almost on the same day, a while later. And by that time, Teresa's only real option was palliative care. He chose to have a second transplant to continue. But they felt like they had each other. And the fact, the timing of their transplants was so strange. And the fact that they were going through these experiences at the same time. And bone marrow transplants, for those of you who don't know, are really grueling. And you are isolated. And you're in the bubble, basically, for months or weeks. And so they continued to support each other. And it was at times when there was sometimes no one else around. They'd be up all night. They'd be up in the morning. Everyone went to work. He says, there were days that our blood counts were so low, we weren't allowed to go anywhere. So instead, we'd take trips in our heads. She took me to Vermont and to D.C., where she grew up. And I took her to my hometown and a whole lot of other places. We would laugh at how descriptive and crazy we could get. I mean, living in your head, that's kind of crazy, right? But he says, we decided if you do it all by yourself, it's crazy. But if you do it with at least one other person, it's genius. So they also came up with a plan to celebrate random holidays every day of the year, whether it was time for them or not. We always had hope despite our prognoses, but it made us feel better to get in a lot of Thanksgivings and Halloweens, just in case. We celebrated Hanukkah in October, but squeezed the 8 days into one. We're both Catholic, but it was still fun. Black History Month for us was actually reduced to 3 days, but we still learned a lot. We celebrated Independence Day about 6 times. They made meals together. Your diet is extremely restricted after a bone marrow transplant, and you have to be really, really careful. You don't go out to eat. You're crazy about washing your hands. So every time, one night, they called each other, like, oh, we need to eat something. And so they both opened their refrigerators and took a picture and sent it to the other one. And one of them had yogurt, and one of them had Pedialyte. And so they're like, great, we're going to have Yogalyte. He says, the things we shared with each other didn't all have to do with cancer. Actually, about 80% of the time, we wanted to get as far away from it as possible. We would SD together, which was our code word for skydiving, which was also code word for getting high on pain meds, and then ask each other the most interesting questions. So he learned about her first car, her first kiss, how she felt when her husband proposed, her lucky pencil. They knew these intimate details. They never met each other. But their lives by this time were so intertwined. She spent a month educating JT on the brilliance of 80s music, and he, in turn, tried to keep her hip. I kept her up on current events, cancer fashion, technology. But in her final days, she was able to tell me she would be going on hospice care. And even though she spent her final moments in California, as I lay in a hospital in Texas, her family made me feel a part of it. I stayed up all night with her family. When they let me know she was gone, the sun was actually rising in Texas. And I thought about how just a few weeks ago, I told her how much I preferred sunrises over sunsets. It never ceases to amaze me how something so magical could happen during such a difficult time. When days were spent managing the grinding pain, the intractable nausea, the battle against death, the magic is this. Amidst the suffering, something within me came alive. Perhaps the most important thing I can take away from my friendship with Teresa is that she showed me we don't have to have long careers, lots of money, or find the cure for cancer or poverty to say we made a difference. She lived her life extending her hand to people who felt like they had little to nothing left and showing them the way. To me, there's no truer success in life than somehow acquiring the ability and the power to save someone with love. My fight continues. What has always mattered is that we are together, and this will always be true, even now. So a lot of people question whether online support is real support, and if you have the relationships, if they're the same, or if they're somehow shallower because you don't actually see that person face to face. Well, I'm here to tell you that it does. JT and his partner had a daughter who was born literally weeks after Teresa died, and they named her Teresa. So it's real, and it's important, online, offline, but it's something that we all need to think about. And that's all I have. Should I stay up here? Is don't know if you have any questions. We have about 5 minutes. Sure. I don't know if they post it, but I can send it to you if they don't post it somewhere. All right. Thank you guys for 5 o'clock at the end of the day.